Hello, my name is Andrew Gomeson, and it is my privilege to welcome you to the Culture Watch podcast, a podcast of Speaking for Him. It is such a wonderful opportunity that we have to spend this time together and look at news and current events from a biblical perspective. I hope that you are encouraged by what I have to share today, and that if you are, you will share it with your family and friends. I am so thankful to all of you who listened last week to my 600th Speaking for Him podcast episode. If you did not, take some time to go back and listen to that episode. It was so much fun with my original co-host, Adam McNutt, and with my new co-host, James Wisniewski, just thinking about the past of the podcast and looking to the future. So please avail yourself of that in the archives when you get a chance. With that being said, let's take a look at news for the week of April 8th. We are going to start today with a look at the migrant crisis, specifically in Washington State.
While the left insists we need more illegals to keep the economy running, the fact is we're out of room. Look at Seattle. The city's fresh out of cash and can't afford to house the illegals. The city told them they had to go. No more free hotels, amigo. But they didn't like that. So they're staging a sit-in. Where? The schools. Dozens of them set up camp at the Garfield Park tennis courts. Democrat activists joined them in a show of force. No hotel rooms, no tennis. Investigative journalist Jonathan Cho went there to check it out, and the tennis squatter said, no bueno.
There's someone here who regularly comes to these events that spreads misinformation. And if that person is going to be here recording and spreading misinformation, I'm not sure that we can continue with this press conference at this time.
They're asking you to stop. They're asking you to stop.
It's a public park. We'll have to search. You can go in there. You can call the police if you want. Mira. Ven acá.
Can you get a job?
Don't touch.
Can you get a job?
Don't touch me.
Come in here and show people.
Don't touch me, homie.
What the hell are you? What car are you?
You call me an immigrant?
Are you not an immigrant?
No, bro. Why would you say that?
Because you're Asian.
But a migrant sugar daddy swooped in. A private group volunteered to pay for the illegals' hotel rooms if the taxpayers won't. Only problem is, now there are no open hotel rooms for Americans. So, since money doesn't grow on trees, the free hotel stay ends in 10 days. And once that ends, Seattle may be heading towards a migrant Chaz situation. Tennis, anyone? Investigative journalist and Discovery Institute senior fellow Jonathan Cho joins me now. Snazzy blazer, Jonathan. It looked like they didn't really care how well you were dressed. They don't want reporters to see migrants swatting on children's tennis courts?
Well, Jesse, it's because I'm exposing the truth right now. They don't want to show that they're essentially extorting the city. They're saying, look, if they don't get money, if they don't get resources, if they don't get motels, they're going to stay. They're going to protest. They're going to create, again, you know, chaos. What an attitude of entitlement. And again, I show that through my reporting, through my videos, and the video don't lie, and they don't like that.
So it's a shakedown. They're going to stop American children from playing tennis until you pay for the hotel rooms.
Yeah, the key here is disruption, and disruption gets the attention of lawmakers and city officials. And credit to Councilmember Joy Hollingsworth, who represents District 3, the Central District neighborhood, a historically black neighborhood, let me mention. By the way, she's saying right now the city has no money. But again, she mentioned that the state legislature earmarked $30 million for these migrants. So it's still unclear, though, when that money's going to come through.
Okay, the first thing that I want to say about this is that regardless of how you feel about what government is responsible for in the lives of its citizens, you must admit that governments have limited resources. It is utterly ridiculous to continuously come up with ways to spend money when you don't have money. So that is the starting point that I want to enforce on this story. Beyond that, though, we have talked in previous episodes about the way these illegal immigrants come over and just expect things to be provided for them. And the reality is, as I often say, there is a legal way to come to the United States, and it may be fraught with difficulty, but it is available. And when immigrants come over in the manner that these are showing themselves to be, it is an insult to everyone who has gone about it the hard way. And so I really think it is incumbent upon us in this great country of America to make sure that we do what we can to keep our borders open, but we also have a responsible approach to this issue. Because remember, we've talked in the past about other cities with these problems. I think it was New York a few weeks ago, we were talking about the fact that certain students were being sent home to do online learning because their schools were being used to mitigate the migrant crisis. You have a bunch of liberal cities now who are saying we don't have the resources to keep up with this influx of migrants and we need to do something about it. But that is exactly why the immigration process is what it is. Not to keep people out, but to make sure that we are prepared and ready for the people that do come in. And I guess also to keep people out, to clarify, but more so to manage the influx of people. Because wherever you go, there is a limit to the resources that we have. And if we aren't even taking care of our own citizens, specifically our veterans, who often get left in the gutter, metaphorically, if not literally, then what are we doing turning around and offering so much to those who come here illegally? Yes, America is a great place. And yes, the American dream has merit. You can accomplish a lot in the United States that you can't accomplish in other countries. But the very fact that you can accomplish so much is backed up by the fact that it takes effort to get here. And if you're willing to come here and do things the way they are meant to be done, then you will be rewarded by the satisfaction of living in a land of liberty where you can pursue whatever dreams you have. And I think that the government, so many times, whether on this issue or on a myriad of others, they approach things under the guise of helping, but they actually hamstring. And we're going to talk more extensively on that particular approach that the government has as we go on today. But wrapping up this particular story, I just want to say this. That I believe that America is one of the greatest places to live. I'm grateful to have grown up here. I'm grateful to be a citizen of this wonderful country. But I also know that we have laws for a reason. And having the expectation that all of your needs and wants will be provided as long as you make a big enough stink, which is what they're trying to accomplish by being on the tennis courts of a school, is a ridiculous expectation. And we need to stop this attitude of having a welfare state in the United States of America. Because we're not only creating this kind of attitude from people that are illegals, but we're also creating this kind of attitude from people that are here. As a disabled American, I use disability pay on a monthly basis. But I have been working my hardest to get myself off of the government dole. It has been made difficult by unreasonable standards from the very program that is supposed to help. They have, throughout my life, put unrealistic expectations upon me as a member of the disabled community. I even went a year without disability income because they said I was making too much money, but it wasn't nearly enough to get off of their dole. So there needs to be a better, more realistic approach to helping people really succeed. Barack Obama once said that the mark of a good government program was a program where people would only be on it temporarily, and that the goal of that program would be to get them off. But that doesn't seem to be the approach of so many in our government today. And I really think that's one of the reasons why so many people want to come to America, sadly, is that they think that things will be given to them on a silver platter. And that's not what we should be about in the United States of America. Unless you think this is an unbiblical approach, that we should just swing wide the doors with no expectations, I submit to you that when people chose to dwell with the children of Israel, they were to be accepted kindly, but they also had expectations on them. They were also supposed to abide by the things that the children of Israel did. And so I think it's very important for us to realize that it is not unfair or unkind to have expectations of people that come to dwell in the United States of America. My next story is very telling. Fox News Digital did a recent survey where they asked American voters about the American dream.
We have the best economy in the world. We got to make it better. We really do have the best economy in the world.
The comparison is always the rest of the world. Anyway, that was President Biden, obviously, bragging about the state of his economy. But despite what the president says, Americans are not buying it because they don't feel it. Parents and grandparents who spoke with Fox News Digital say they are not optimistic about the future of the American dream.
It's dying.
I think it's in the middle. People haven't given up hope entirely, but I think a lot of people are doubtful.
You can't afford the American dream with what we wanted when we were young. It's not something really our kids can afford.
Because it's too expensive. We've got ours, but our kids and our grandkids can't afford homes, and they can't afford to do the things they'd like to do.
Kind of dead. I just think it's really hard to change where you're at in life these days. It's possible, but it's extremely difficult.
Kind of lost our way. I mean, it's impossible for the younger generation to afford housing. I mean, a car costs what my parents bought a house for. Like stuff like that. And I mean, wages have remained stagnant.
I think we kind of are a caste system at this point. So where you start is generally where you end up.
You know, the American dream is like a Rocky movie where he's on the ropes and he's been beaten up pretty bad. But, you know, in most Rocky movies, he gets up and comes back and wins in the end. I'm hoping that's the case.
The American dream is definitely alive. There's such great opportunity here in America, and I'm a proud business owner and building my dream.
No, I think it's definitely alive and well. You just have to work for it. You got to put in the time. You have to start from the bottom, do your, you know, do the dirty work, do the grind, and make your way up.
So some people believing in it, and most people not from just that gathering of voices there. But the thing that stuck out the most to me, Kennedy, was we're like a caste system, which means you don't rise.
Yeah, that negative, Nancy, I don't necessarily believe in that. The American history is written by people who either came to this country with nothing or started out with nothing. And, you know, Charles is an incredible example of that. You know, he just shared the story of his mom and two brothers living in one room in New York after a long bus ride. And he is the richest man I know. He literally has an office and a jet made of gold.
Not just in
no,
this
but
room,
it's an
honey.
Incredible story. And there's so many people like that. We have to listen to them. We have to listen to
no, it's true.
What it took. What was their struggle?
Yep.
What did they have to sacrifice? It is still possible. It's harder now with the federal government screwing with everything from housing to education to interest rates. But it is possible and achievable.
And vote in your own interests.
Amen.
Don't just check boxes and do what people tell you to do and vote how they want you to vote. If you want things to change, you got to make change.
Yeah. What resonated with me was the comment,
I think it was the same woman, though, where she said, yes, it's still here, but it's a lot harder than it was. That's exactly how I feel. The American dream is never dead. But under this administration and under these policies that have destroyed everything, regulations just choke entrepreneurial dreams. The inflation, the money, everything. It is so hard to succeed at this moment. It is so hard to improve anything. If you're not already in the real estate industry, if you don't already own your own home, if you don't already have that degree, no. There are so many things. I feel it every day. And if I do, I know millions do alongside of me. And it is not getting any easier.
From the top down, we see policies getting in the way of people doing what they need to do to make their dreams come true. Business regulations kill entrepreneurial spirit, and they make it very hard for people to succeed in bringing products and services to others in a reasonable way. And it's so important for us to realize that if we want to be able to realize the American dream, we need to favor small government with reduced regulations from what we have now. Because we saw through the COVID pandemic the power that the government has to regulate business and to make people do things just because they say so. We saw virtually the entire country shut down for months at a time, and the hoops that businesses had to jump through in order to reopen were ridiculous. The government needs to get out of the way of the innovators of our country and say, you go do your business, you do the best you can for as many people as you can, and make America better for it. Instead, between taxes and other regulations, it can be very difficult to be a small business owner, particularly in the United States. And we see this when we see the minimum wage going up ridiculously throughout the country. We just saw many businesses lay off hundreds of employees because the minimum wage in California went up to $20 an hour. And we see other things that people would like to do business-wise, but then they always have to be worried about following business regulations. One perfect example is the selling of goods from a farm. I remember a few years back there was a big controversy because big government didn't want people selling raw milk. And on one hand, you look at that and you say, well, that makes sense. You don't want people to get hurt. I get it. But on the other hand, think about this. If you have a problem with a line of pasteurized milk at the supermarket, then what happens? There is a line-wide, nationwide, potentially, recall of that dairy product. But if I sell my neighbor some milk and my neighbor gets sick, then I can be made aware that there is a problem with my cow's milk, and I can tell you exactly where that milk came from. So it is far better for communities to regulate that stuff than it is for big government. But everything that the government does is about power and control. And the problem is that whenever we have a problem, our tendency as a society is to look to government to solve it. And I really think, for a myriad of reasons, but specifically from an economic standpoint, we need to not look to government to solve our problems. We need to get people into office who are going to empower the average American person to make their own way in the world. My friend and I were actually talking about this several months ago, about how this assumption of the two-income household affects everyone, whether you're married or not. Because as soon as it became the norm for society that you could have a two-income household, every expense went up, particularly expenses related to real estate, because mortgages could be more expensive because you were relying on two incomes to pay the mortgage. When insurance became a thing for medical purposes, medical bills went up. When college loans became the norm, college expenses went up. And when government took over control of college loans, they got even worse. So let's stop having this attitude that the government can just solve our problems. And let's instead empower the American people, the American business owner, to make the economy better, because he will. I don't think a lot of people realize the ramifications of adding $2 or $3 an hour to the minimum wage. I was talking to my brother about this recently, and we were discussing the fact that over the last several years in Michigan, it seems like there's been a number of employers that have been, like, on average between $2 and $3 above minimum wage to start people out. But if you raise the minimum wage by another $3 or $4, suddenly those employers who are out of their benevolence and out of what they have earned giving really good wages are now looked at as bad because the same budget is required to put them at just minimum wage. And that's not even to mention that certain organizations are nonprofit, and so they do all they can to scrape together people to handle all their overhead needs and pay them competitive wages while still pouring the majority of their money into whatever cause they are trying to benefit. I can reflect on this from my days at Right to Life of Michigan, because I believe it was for the final 5 years of my time at Right to Life, I never got a raise. It might have been as little as 3, but I know it was a long time. But during the time I was at Right to Life, the minimum wage went from $5.85 in Michigan to $7.40 in Michigan in a year and a half. My wages did not go up commensurate with that raise, because it was hard enough for Right to Life to pay the people just coming in to the business that kind of money because of the change in the law. So I think one of the things that we need to work on is thinking about all the aspects that will be affected when we make a suggestion about how things should change. And I feel like a lot of times when particularly people on the left have an idea, they'll say, well, this seems like a good idea, but they don't think about the steps that are needed to take in order to implement that idea. And you really need to consider the economic ramifications of dramatic raises in the minimum wage. The word minimum is key when discussing the minimum wage. It's not supposed to be the end-all be-all. It's not supposed to be a living wage. It's supposed to be a starting point so that you grab onto that bottom rung of the ladder and you start up the ladder and you become better and better and get compensated more and more for your experience level and for the effort you put in to whatever business you're working in. Now, I will attest to some personal frustrations about this because I would have thought that I would have been much farther along in my career journey by now. But that doesn't mean that raising the minimum wage would have greatly benefited me, because all it would have done is put greater pressure on my employers to not employ me anymore. Because in their minds, they probably could find someone better for the same amount of money. And these are the things that people need to consider when they start griping about the minimum wage. I'll never forget, several years ago when Seattle's minimum wage went up, there was a guy who worked at a pizza place who was raving about how excited he was that minimum wage was going to go up that week. And then after that story aired, he was let go because the company needed to make cuts and he was on the bubble. And so we really need to be careful that when we're talking about the economy, that we understand how economics works. Because another aspect of this is that when you raise the wages of everyone, when you raise what the minimum means, and keep in mind, minimum is the bottom of the expectation, then prices go up. And then everybody struggles even more. And so there's so many different aspects of the economy that need to be considered when making economic decisions. Our next story is related because we're going to look at the California minimum wage.
Let's bring in California restaurant owner and chef Andrew Gruhl. Andrew, good to see you. So, Andrew, make sense of this for me. You're a California guy. If $20 an hour is good for California restaurant workers, why isn't $20 an hour good for Gavin Newsom's restaurant workers?
Well, this is classic Newsom, classic California. Yeah. Put another feather in Newsom's hat of hypocrisy. This actually reminds me a little bit of the pandemic, no? Restaurants, Newsom, hypocrisy. The guy can't champion or, you know, stand behind all the things that he kind of virtue signals for. But that's just typical. And I mean, that actually applies not just to Newsom. That applies to all of the politicians who are out there talking about we need $50 minimum wage, which is what Barbara Lee said. But then the government workers themselves are only making $15, $16, $17 an hour. And it's absurd, but it's typical. It's completely typical of California.
So we have immediately seen, Andrew, layoffs. We have seen price increases. So that's inflation that actually layoffs and price increases hurts the people that this new $20 minimum wage that these politicians claim they're trying to help.
This bill was marketed as something that was supposed to help the workers and hurt the corporations, but it's actually helping the corporations and it's hurting the workers in the long run. And by virtue, these small businesses as well, who ultimately are going to have to pay a lot more than this, but don't have the money to automate. You see, they're laying off all these workers, and the workers that are staying there, as that girl said, you know, they're going to have double the amount of work, but then the costs are going to go up, the prices are going to go up, and all those workers in those communities now are going to have to spend more money because the prices of everything have already gone up. You see, they don't think these things through. If they wanted to help the worker, they could have cut payroll taxes, which is the highest in the nation. They could have cut the ETT, which nobody knows where that goes to, unemployment insurance, any of those things, put more money in the workers' pockets, which then could have helped the businesses, and they can incentivize the businesses to pay their workers more by virtue of changing that incentive structure.
That's too common sense, though, Andrew. You're a restaurant owner, though. Tell us what impact this has had on your ability to run your restaurant. We got about 30 seconds.
Well, I think in general what this is going to do is it's going to kind of change the whole entire economy because prices are going to go up so significantly, and we're going to see that from the distributors, from the food products all around, even if you're not part of this kind of fast food coalition that got targeted by this bill. You see, because by proxy, they're targeting everybody. So it's going to be difficult. Fortunately, we pay our workers a ton of money because we believe in this, but we're not doing it because the government's mandating us to.
So the California minimum wage law says $20 an hour for fast food and $16 an hour for other industries. And I assume, based on what this piece said about Gavin Newsom's restaurants, that that includes non-fast food restaurants. So, aside from the fact that it's a lot of money off the top, it's also strange that fast food workers get a $20 minimum wage and other workers in other industries get less, $16. Again, we're talking about minimum wage, so hopefully if you get into a job, you can excel and do better than the minimum. That should be the goal of every worker, is to do well enough that you can get raises and stay in your job and build a career in whatever you have chosen to build it in. But it just seems extremely bizarre to have all these loopholes. I know we talked about this bill a couple weeks ago in the sense of having a loophole for a company with a bakery. But to simplify it, what I have read online is $20 an hour for fast food workers and $16 for other industries. So isn't it interesting that we have all these politicians clamoring for the supposed citizens to get higher wages for various industries, and yet state employees, as was mentioned in this piece, get paid so little? I'll never forget when Bernie Sanders was running for president, he made this big deal about how wages needed to go up across the country, and then it was found that he was paying his people that were working on his campaign less money than his competitors' campaigns. So hypocrisy tends to run deep along these lines. And I think the most important thing, as I said, is that if you get into a job and you do well at a job, you should be well compensated. I've even heard some people say that the minimum wage should be eliminated. And that seems like a radical thing, but if you think about it, it makes sense in some ways. Because is there really a fear that if the minimum wage was eliminated, somebody's going to offer to pay you only $4 an hour because they no longer had to pay you a minimum wage? No, they're still going to want to pay you enough to keep you. They still have to have good workers. So it would be irresponsible of them to do something that ridiculous and say, I'm only going to pay you this much because I only have to. But again, like we were saying with the previous story, if you have good employees, you should pay them because they will help you to produce good work, and you should have the ability to pay them because you should keep more of your money because it should not be stripped down by regulation. It is so important for us to think about, as I said, the long-term ramifications of these things. How are all these people who were excited about the $20 minimum wage in California feeling in the days after when they got their pink slip? Because they either didn't have enough experience or didn't do a good enough job to retain the jobs that they had at the new rate. Because ultimately, employers are going to employ the best employees they can get for the money that they have to pay those employees. I'll never forget reading a book about the New Deal with FDR and finding out that during that period of American history, there was a brief time when there was a woman's minimum wage. You know what that did? It made people hire less women. Because employers said, I can save money by hiring men. So it did the exact opposite of what they were trying to do. The final story that I want to share with you comes out of the presidential campaign. You know that the liberal media is doing everything they can to discredit Donald Trump at every turn. And this latest example is one of the more blatant.
Right now, the media, quick to pounce on former President Donald Trump's remarks regarding Laken Riley's accused killer. Several outlets and even the Biden campaign claim that Trump called migrants at large animals. But the Trump campaign insists they are once again taking his remarks out of context. Let's bring in Fox News contributor Joe Concha for more on this. So here's what Trump said in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that caused the firestorm. Joe, listen here.
And just a few weeks ago, I met with the grieving family of Laken Riley, the 22-year-old nursing student in Georgia who was barbarically murdered by an illegal alien animal.
So the Biden campaign picked that up, just the part where he said that the word animal, and said, oh, Trump is calling illegal immigrants at large animals, subhuman, and then the media ran with it, Joe.
Yeah, what this shows without ambiguity, John, is that a growing number of news outlets exist for two reasons: to make Republicans and especially Donald Trump look bad, and to assist Democrats and especially the Biden campaign in making them look good. Basic truth, facts, and be damned. And John, you could go out onto the street after this program and you could ask 100 people if they think 22-year-old Laken Riley being beaten to death in Georgia by a man who attacked her for no reason is the act of an animal, or if 25-year-old Ruby Garcia being shot multiple times and being left on the side of a road to die in Michigan at the hands of someone who entered this country illegally is the act of an animal. An overwhelming majority of people would tell you that the animal description is appropriate. And by the way, we've seen this movie before, John. Back in 2018, Donald Trump, as president, called members of MS-13 animals. And this was in light of multiple instances of these gang members brutally torturing their victims first before murdering them in the most horrific of fashion. The acts of animals. But I can provide you dozens of examples of news outlets back in 2018 at that time, purposely omitting the part about Trump specifically talking about MS-13 members and presenting instead a version where they accused Trump of calling all immigrants, legal, illegal, all combined into one entity, as animals. So I would say the fact checkers will be coming to the rescue here in 2024. But you look at PolitiFact and Snopes, John, and I'll leave it here. They're ignoring this instance when it probably would be the easiest fact check they can do.
Yeah, back to 2018, the New York Times was one of those outlets that said Trump calls some unauthorized immigrants animals in rant. He was talking about people who are notorious for murder, decapitation, dismemberment, rape, among other things. Here's how this all got going in the last couple of days. The Biden campaign's rapid response posted a video of Trump on X with the quote, "Democrats said, please don't call immigrants animals. I said, no, they're not humans, they're animals." What Trump actually said was, "Democrats said, please don't call them animals," referring to the alleged murderer of Laken Riley. But the horse was out of the gate. That meme got picked up by Reuters, which said Donald Trump called immigrants illegally in the United States, quote, animals and not human, in a speech in Michigan on Tuesday, resorting to the degrading rhetoric he has employed time and again on the campaign trail. And it didn't stop there. There was this incident on a rival cable network. Watch here.
Okay. When he says these immigrants are animals, they're not humans, what does that suggest? I mean, isn't that brutal? Shouldn't people be condemning that?
I listened to the entire tape. He was specifically talking about the person who murdered Laken Riley in Georgia. And to be honest with you, Wolf, if somebody murders another human being, I think they deserve to be called animals.
Joe, I think there's a lot of people who would agree with Scott Jennings that if a member of their family was brutally murdered by somebody, whether they're here illegally or not, they could refer to that person indeed as an animal.
Yeah, John. Good for Scott Jennings, by the way, because obviously he calls out his own network for purposely cutting off half the quote there, Wolf Blitzer, in that particular case. And there were other instances of that happening as well. The only thing I could say is that at least now the playing field is being leveled in terms of, yes, Fox News has been around for a long time, but social media and particularly Twitter/X, more and more people on there are calling BS on this and getting tons of views into the millions as far as here's what Trump said and here's what happened. So legacy media doesn't have solely the microphone anymore.
However you feel about Donald Trump, if you are a believer in Jesus Christ, you should believe in hearing the whole truth and responding to the whole truth. So this myth perpetuated by the media that Donald Trump called all illegal immigrants animals has been proven inaccurate if you listen to the whole tape. That gentleman on the CNN piece was willing to call it out and say, I heard the whole piece. It's not what you're perpetuating. And so I really appreciate that, that it got called out, especially on a left-leaning network like CNN. I'm reminded of a proverb that says, he that answereth a matter before he heareth it, the same is a folly and a shame to him. And so I think it's very important for us to make sure that we get our facts, that we don't run with a snippet, and we don't make a salacious headline for the purposes of making a salacious headline. You know, it used to be that news was at 6 p.m. and 11 p.m. And so if you got wind of a story at 10 a.m., you had 6 to 8 hours to prepare and get ready to present that news at 6 p.m. And so there was a lot more time to make sure that the facts you have are right, to make sure that you have the right angle on the story, or even to make sure that there's a specific story there that's worth telling. Nowadays, we have 24-hour news stations. And so 30 seconds after something happens, the news stations go to air. And they're not necessarily thorough about making sure they have the right information. They just go ahead and bring to air what they have. And that can be very dangerous. It can be very harmful to the people who are involved in these stories. And I just feel like there is a lot of that going around on the news cycles these days. I think people on both sides of news issues need to make sure that they are presenting things in a responsible and truthful way, because we can all, in our zeal to make things known or render an opinion, we can all do a disservice to the facts at times, but we need to make sure that what we say is true. We need to make sure that we are using our mouths in a good way to edify the hearers, that even when we are presenting hard truths, that we do so in love, with the purpose of making people better for having heard what we have to say, and not with the purpose of tearing someone down. This is so important. And so I really hope that people will continue to expose those who want to share only half truths, and that they will continue to look at the context of the things people say, not just the words that they say. I think that is one of the biggest nuances that's gone from news coverage or any sort of discussions, is nuance. It's not just what you say, it's how you say it. Well, that's about all I have time for on today's episode of the Culture Watch podcast. I hope that you've been benefited by what you've heard today, and that if you are, you will share it with your family and friends. If you have any feedback on today's episode and you would like to share it with me, please make sure you reach out with the contact information that's about to roll at the end of the show. And please make sure, as you discuss these important issues with others, that you are also sharing with them the hope that can only be found in Jesus Christ. With that being said, I hope you have a wonderful week, and that you keep serving the best of masters.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Your host has been Andrew Gamson, founder of Speaking for Him. For more information on today's show and to leave us comments and voicemails, visit speakingforhim.blogspot.com.
You can find Andrew's ministry at speakingforhim.com. That's speaking, the number 4, H-I-M. You can also interact with us at facebook.com/speakingforhim and on Twitter at speakingforhim. And when you look for us on iTunes and Stitcher, let us know what you think of the podcast by leaving a rating and review.